You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. And welcome to episode 333. And in this one, I chat with Dr. Roberto Olivardia. Roberto is a clinical psychologist and a clinical instructor of psychology at Harvard Medical School. In this one, we go into detail into attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, and also alongside OCD. And in particular, we talk about Roberto's therapy story, his personal story with ADHD, the school system and ADHD, what ADHD is, the comorbidity of OCD and ADHD together, how ADHD can feed into OCD, common OCD themes he sees with ADHD, how ADHD can undermine therapy for OCD if untreated, shame in ADHD and OCD, making accommodations for ADHD to enhance OCD treatment, medication for ADHD, why ADHD gets undiagnosed in OCD and more so in women, and much more. Really enjoyed this one. I personally learned a lot. Hope you guys do too. And thank you to NoCD for supporting the podcast. NoCD offers affordable, effective, and convenient therapy available in the US and outside the US. To find out more about NoCD, their therapy plans, if they currently take your insurance, or to download their free app, head over to go.treatmyocd.com/theOCDstories, or the link will be in the episode description. So thank you, as always, to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And of course, thank you to Roberto for his time. And without further ado, here he is. Welcome to the show, Roberto.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
That is good to have you on. And before we get started on today's topic, OCD and ADHD, which is a widely requested topic, I'd like to hear, you know, your therapy journey. What got you into being a therapist, a psychologist, and why then specifically OCD and ADHD?
So that's a good question. So I guess I think of it as my story probably starts when I was 4 years old. I'll give you the edited version. When I was 4 years old, and my mom and I were in Boston Common, which is sort of downtown Boston, Massachusetts, where I'm born and raised, and saw this man who thought he yelled into the public that he was Jesus Christ. And was just screaming that he was the Messiah, that he was Jesus Christ. And I asked my mom, I said, why is he saying that? Like, I don't think he's Jesus. I mean, I wasn't particularly religious, but I'm like, I don't think he's Jesus Christ, but I think he thinks he's Jesus Christ. And my mom, we said, oh, you know, there's something wrong with his brain. His brain doesn't work correctly. And I think it was very evident probably to her that I was always very curious about people, and there was no explanation that sort of satisfied me as to why that was happening. And she said, how do you know he thinks he is, you know, as opposed to like, this guy is lying. I said, no, I can see it in his eyes that he thinks he really thinks he is. And that's weird because I know he's not. And how does that happen? And that was sort of the beginning of just a life of just always being very curious about people and what makes people the way that they are, including myself. You know, how do I understand myself in ways? And then I'm a huge music fanatic and big music fan. And if I wasn't doing this, I would definitely be doing something in that world. And music is all about feeling and emotion and connecting with experiences and humanity. And so I think that world also had me always very intellectually curious. And I was always a very empathic, very emotionally sensitive kid. And I think that that combined, but my experience particularly, I have ADHD myself, and I really didn't like school at all prior to college. After college, it was great, but I really hated school prior. But the one class, my senior year of high school, was psychology. And it was the first class that I absolutely loved and did 100% of the homework for, and did even more than was assigned. I thought, oh, this is something academically, because I always knew I was interested in people, but I didn't really understand there was an academic discipline. And then that got me into psychology. And And then I think with OCD, my interest actually really came from working with men with eating disorders. That's a whole area of specialty that I work with, boys and men with eating disorders. And then a number of them also had OCD. And then all my clinical training has been at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts. They have a world-renowned obsessive compulsive disorders program there, the OCD Institute, top-notch. And so I had training there, and that got me very interested in OCD. And then with ADHD, I think partly because of my own experience with ADHD, and just seeing it comorbid with literally every, I mean, with OCD, with binge eating disorder, with depression. I mean, ADHD, as we'll talk about today, is much more common than people think. And so even if you're not a clinical expert in ADHD, every clinician out there is working with patients with ADHD, whether they know it or not. And so to me, that combined, I'm always interested in the comorbidities of ADHD with a number of things, including OCD.
That's interesting. With your journey, not to reveal too much if you don't want, but did you get therapy, medication? What helped you as you were kind of growing up and dealing with ADHD?
Yeah, no, and I'm very open talking about my experience. So I grew up at a time, I'm going to be 50 this year. And when I was younger, ADHD, I mean, what we know now about ADHD is completely different than what we knew even 10 years ago, let alone 40 years ago about ADHD. When I was a kid, the kids that were diagnosed with ADHD were kids that were conduct disordered, that were burning the school down, that were like at high risk of dropping out of school, you know, the sort of like quote unquote troubled kids. Those were the kids that were diagnosed. And I had friends who were diagnosed even back then, but they were those kids. Like they were those kids that, you know, people were very concerned were going down a very dark path. So if you were someone like me, which I had good social skills, I was bright enough that I could navigate through school. I wouldn't call myself a great student, honestly, until like college and on, but I knew what I had to do to get by. As a lot of folks with ADHD, I waited till the last minute to get things done. I would pull things off. I never read books from cover to cover. I'd sort of just skip and read around them. I think I probably also had an undiagnosed learning disability. I have two kids. Both of them have ADD and dyslexia. So it was not something that was sort of known. And even what's funny is that even in graduate school, and this is something that I hope has changed, is that for something as common as ADHD is, it affects anywhere from 8 to 10% of the population. We didn't really learn much about it, even in my PhD program. I learned more about schizophrenia, which affects 1% of the population. And I should know about schizophrenia, but I mean, 8 to 10% of the population. And I didn't. So even in graduate school, I would learn about, I thought, okay, people with ADHD, a higher risk of addiction and conduct disorders, oppositional defiant disorder, all these things that I didn't. It wasn't until my late 20s and early 30s when I started working with patients. And then the research started catching up and you started having a higher body of research. And I thought, this is very familiar to me. And luckily it was actually before the birth of my first child, because it was very, I mean, this is very heritable and it was very evident that it's within my family. And I joke, but it's true. I could have diagnosed my son prenatally with ADHD, and he's 17 years old now. And as I understood it and read about it, I thought, oh my gosh, this is me. So how did I get by was I could always consider myself very strategic. And I think when you have ADHD, that is definitely part of the code words of you have to develop strategies. And I developed strategies, some of which were very unconventional and bizarre, but it's what I had to do to sort of, you know, get through. And then create sort of like, what's this narrative about how I learn and what kind of person I am. And, you know, like, thankfully I never thought I was stupid. But I did I didn't think that I was a good student. Like I didn't think, I thought in the way that was, I was a bit of a fraud in school, like getting A's and B's, and I got a plenty of C's in high school. But because I just thought, yeah, I just knew how to kind of navigate it. You know, I didn't really do all of the work all of the time. Now that changed in college, because in college I knew I wanted to be a clinical psych major. And then with ADHD, if we know, if we love something, we are all in it. But the problem is if we don't love it, it's like there's no juice flowing, you know, to kind of really connect to it. So I kind of sort of learned along the way. I never took medication. I'm not anti-medication at all. I think actually, if I knew when I was younger, particularly in high school, what I know now, there's no question that medication would have been beneficial for me. And in high school, particularly, high school was brutal. It was not fun for me. I bombed the SATs. And I mean, just like that would have been helpful. I think at this point, because I love what I do, which is, I think an upside of ADHD is because I get bored so easily, I have to do something that I love. Like it's not even negotiable. And I'm so stimulated by what I do. I don't need it really. Like I'm kind of, I'm doing what, you know, I need to do in that way, but it would have been helpful in previous years without a doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for being open there. And I guess maybe I don't know if I'm getting too political. I don't mean in an actual politics way, but if we think about the school system, both in the UK and in the US and probably most countries that are listening to this, it's very much that industrial, you know, straight rows. You're sitting in the UK, we have straight rows. I know you guys are lined up, but usually individual desks, at least to what I can tell from the movies.
Yes.
and for someone with ADHD, I can imagine that's just torture, like having to, you know. So it's, not,
awful.
It's the environment that's wrong, not the individual, at least for that person.
100%. And that's one of the things that I, you know, there's so much misunderstanding around ADHD. And that's a large part of the work in that area, is really helping people understand, you know, it's not an illness. It's not a brain defect. It's simply the way your brain is wired. And in some settings, that brain could excel. And in other settings, it could really, really be difficult. And just even, you know, that I often make a reference when I give talks about ADHD, that my seventh grade English teacher, I remember walking into that class and she had the desks in a circle. And immediately my brain was lit up like, oh, cool. Like we're engaging. We're going to connect. We're going to engage. Just the environment, just literally putting those desks in a circle. So we're all looking at each other as opposed to the typical rows, which I would just, I mean, I'd fall asleep behind. I always hope that somebody tall sat in front of me so that I can close my eyes without the teacher, you know, seeing. But the thing with ADHD is that the term is a bit of a misnomer. It's not that we lack attention. It's more of an attention dysregulation. Like if I'm interested in something, I can be a workhorse. Like I can put 20 hours straight into something, you know, what we call the hyperfocus. The issue is that if I'm not interested in it, it's really, really hard to focus and to connect. And so that for me, like if I think back to high school, either was equivalent to just totally falling asleep, like drooling down my face, I mean, falling out cold, or being a bit of a class clown and just kind of being funny and just getting the class riled up, because that was almost a way of self-stimulating, really. And so that's the part of ADHD, coupled with issues of impulsivity, of hyperactivity, and then all the executive function issues, which are all those cognitive processes that we need to get things done, prioritizing, time management. That's the part of ADHD. And that's why it's so important for people to understand it goes beyond school. I mean, executive functions are necessary for living, I mean, for life. So it affects every life domain. Every life domain is affected by ADHD. Sleep, eating, getting things done, you name it.
Well, yeah, thank you for that. And what are the comorbidity rates of OCD and ADHD together?
So we know that there are studies that have looked at OCD samples and mm-hmm. have found that anywhere of upwards of 20 to 30% of people with OCD have ADHD. Wow. I have not come across studies that have looked at samples of ADHD that have assessed for OCD. But I would say that that's probably right in line with what I see clinically in my practice, that it's much more comorbid than people think. And with OCD and ADHD, we think of them as almost being these opposite conditions in a way, you know, that the person with OCD is almost like super focused on their obsessions. The ADHD person is highly distracted. You know, the OCD person is so rigid and aversive to things. The ADHD person is impulsive and kind of, you know, and if anything, tripping over boundaries and things like that. But if you think of OCD also as a dysregulation of attention, I mean, in a lot of ways, it's an attention disorder as well. Like someone with OCD is spending, their thoughts get sticky to something that they don't, aren't working for them, that we don't want them thinking, you know, about, and they're unable to move from, let's say if they have an intrusive thought, as we all have intrusive thoughts, but someone with OCD, that intrusive thought gets sticky, you know, in that way. And so when you have both ADHD and OCD, it can be very difficult to sort of to navigate, because sometimes it could be more the ADHD at play, sometimes it's the OCD, and sometimes it's one starts and the other kind of follows. I call it, like, it can be a very toxic couple, you know, in a way. And, you know, and I wouldn't identify as having OCD. That's not an experience I live with daily. However, I would say that I definitely have those traits for certain things, like around like health issues. And when I was younger and I first got my driver's license, I definitely had, like, I would call like an episode, a period of time where driving was very anxiety provoking for me because of the idea of harming other people. I was never afraid of me getting into an accident, but I was almost weighted with this idea in my head of like, oh my gosh, like I'm behind this thing being a car, this wheel that could literally wipe out an entire family of four. Like if I move the wrong way, go into the wrong lane. And it was really, really very difficult. I mean, I just didn't want to drive. I was totally comfortable with the idea of other people driving. And it wasn't until, and this is where the ADHD probably helped, is that I could either take a 2.5 hour commute into town. I was in graduate school at the time, or I could drive there and it would take me 20 minutes. And my ADHD, which is like, yeah, this is way too much time. Like, we'll just deal with it, you know, kind of helped in some ways, honestly, you know, in that way. But I can understand that same thinking, because like with health stuff, I would say that those kind of two processes work together for me, because when I do have, let's say, a sensation in my body and I'm like, oh, like, what's that? I in some ways feel that the ADHD is at play because I'm so distracted by it. Like I almost, even if I try to focus on something else, like I'm like, my head is like, oh, that's where the stimulation is, even though it's an anxious stimulation, but it's still stimulation. The ADHD brain always leans towards what is the most stimulating thing in the environment. Mm-hmm. Everything that's pleasurable is stimulating, but there are a lot of stimulating things that aren't pleasurable. Anxiety, danger, conflict, drama, all very stimulating, not pleasurable, but the ADHD brain would prefer leaning into those things. And I can tell you as a kid, very dangerous, crazy things I did as a kid that now I look back and like, oh my gosh, you know, what was I thinking? But now as I understand the ADHD brain, I'm like, I totally understand what it was. It was leaning into where the stimulation was. And when you have OCD, unfortunately, one of the things that for people who have OCD and ADHD is those obsessive thoughts are very stimulating. And so that ADD part of the brain is, let's say, ooh, let's lean into this, even though it's not, obviously, there's nothing pleasurable about it.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. And what does, for someone with ADHD, leaning into the place that creates the most stimulation, what does that do for the person with ADHD?
So what we know, and this is what I found just in my experience, was so validating. And even if I'm working with someone as young as 6 years old to 76, I basically give them a lot of this information and break it down to whatever language makes sense for them in understanding the ADHD brain. Mm-hmm. So what we know is we have various neurochemicals in the brain, and one of them is dopamine. And dopamine is implicated in reward. It's implicated in motivation. So when we, you know, run through the finish line of a race, or when we eat a great meal, or when we're at a concert, our dopamine levels are elevating. Now, there are a lot of unhealthy things that raise dopamine. Cannabis, for example, raises dopamine. Thrill-seeking behaviors, some of which could be very dangerous, raise levels of dopamine. What we know about the ADHD brain is that it is in a dopamine deficit. So at baseline, we have lower levels of dopamine at baseline. So I think of ADHD in a lot of ways as an orientation, honestly, that I am oriented to my environment by what is going to raise my dopamine levels. And so the reason that we do carry a quadruple risk of any kind of addiction, any kind of addictive behavior, whether it's drugs, alcohol, porn, gambling, food, you name it. Like if we like something, we run the risk of liking it too much, is because what we're doing is trying to self-medicate those low levels of dopamine. So that chronic boredom that people with ADHD feel, like boredom is almost the worst state for someone with ADHD to be in, honestly. Like, and it's not that, again, like anxiety is like someone says, oh, I want to be anxious, but from almost a physiological perspective, I often think of boredom as actually more of a distressing state than even being anxious. Because at least if I'm anxious, I'm engaged in something. You know, I don't consciously think that way about it, but I know my brain is operating in that way. So with ADHD, what's so important about knowing that is that we do have to have some stimulation and some ground. Because stimulation, thinking of it, is not something that's going to sort of disengage us from something, but it's actually very grounding for someone with ADHD. So if we're properly stimulated, we're properly grounded in the moment. That's why if you think of the kid, let's say with ADHD, who's kind of squiggling and squirming, they're getting out of their seat, it's because they're not grounded internally enough, that their body is literally searching for something to kind of stimulate them. So when you set up your environment a certain way, that could produce that kind of, you know, grounding. But that's why we always have to also be aware of how we lean into some of those things, because it provides, you know, some of that stimulation that, you know, sometimes we need and sometimes we don't need.
Yeah. Okay. Fascinating. Yeah. So with someone with ADHD or in your clinical practice, do you notice particular themes coming up more often than not in this particular population of people?
Yeah. So with the comorbidity, a lot of times the sort of manifestations of OCD, I would say I see most commonly with people with comorbid OCD and ADHD would be just right OCD, this sort of kind of specificity. And sometimes it's not even coupled with sort of obsessions. It could be more the compulsions. Like I work with many patients who are like, I don't know why it has to be this way, but it just does. Like, I don't fear that anything bad will happen. It just feels almost on a sensory level, very uncomfortable if I don't do it a certain way. And that's not, you know, you see things like that with ADHD as well. Like, I often think with ADHD, there's this kind of hyper-specificity that occurs. When I was in the third grade, I remember we had to write a paragraph of a fictional character that we related to. And a lot of the boys wrote like the Hulk and Superman. And I'm thinking, you don't relate to them. Maybe you want to be them, but really, do you relate to them? So interestingly, and how diagnostic is this, is I wrote Goldilocks from Goldilocks and the Three Bears. And my teacher was like, Goldilocks. And I still remember this very well. I said, well, yeah, because with Goldilocks, this bed was too hard and this bed was too soft. And this one was just right. And this porridge was too hot and this was too cold and this was just right. And I said, I feel like sometimes I need things to be just right for me to just, you know, and I didn't know the word ground myself at the time, but that's what I was referring to. It's like, so with the ADHD experience often is that, like, you need sometimes your environment or the conditions, or like for me to go to bed every night requires like lots of things to be in place for me to literally go to shut my mind off every night. The temperature in my room, the weight of the comforter I sleep with, like all of these things that almost can feel like has like an OCD flavor to it. So the just right OCD I see a lot of obsessive compulsive spectrum disorders. So body focused repetitive behaviors like trichotillomania, skin picking. I work with a lot of individuals who engage in those behaviors, like chronic nail biting. So that has that overlap as well. These are very self-simulating, soothing kind of, you know, behaviors, but can obviously become very impairing and painful. I would say that hoarding is definitely an issue. I mean, hoarding, in fact, now, I mean, what I'm seeing, thankfully, in the hoarding world more is the focus on executive dysfunction. And there's a lot more research now looking at the comorbidity with ADHD, which makes total sense to people in the ADHD community. Why? Because we've been seeing it, you know, the hoarding kind of issues, difficulty throwing things out, all that executive function of what do I keep, when, how long do I keep it? So that comorbidity. And then one of my other areas of specialty is in body dysmorphic disorder, BDD. And I see a lot of that comorbidity as well with BDD and ADHD. I've seen it manifest in different ways, but I would say those are probably the most common that I'll often see that comorbidity.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. And I get you get the classical OCD themes too, right? Contamination, religion, relationship. Yeah.
Definitely.
That's more prevalent, the ones you've mentioned.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Okay. Actually, on BDD, do you have any hypothesis of why that may be?
Yeah. I think that, you know, there's a couple of things. So one is, you know, with a lot of people with ADHD, struggle with self-esteem issues, particularly if their ADHD was undiagnosed. But even when it's diagnosed when they're young, I would dare to say a universal experience. I mean, it's certainly at least with anyone I've ever known with ADHD, where you feel you have this sense of yourself as different at a very young age. And it's, I remember very clearly second grade, silent reading time. We had to pick a book out of the little milk crates and everyone would sit. And I think it was probably only 20 minutes. It felt like 2 hours. And I remember as a kid looking around the class and most people were reading the book. And I thought, are they really reading that? Like I couldn't even, first of all, none of the books were interesting, like, you know, to me. The silence was almost like deafening to me. I'm like, I almost want to like get up and just start like dancing around. How are these people doing that? Like I didn't, it just was so strange. Like other experiences of, you know, falling asleep in class. And I remember saying to a friend of mine, I don't know how you don't find this class boring. And he said, I do find it boring. He goes, but not everybody falls asleep when they're bored. And I thought, okay. You know, like, and just these different things. Now, a lot of my friends growing up were ADHD. I mean, birds of a feather flock together. So thankfully, it wasn't like, oh, I'm so different from everybody on the planet, because I had a cohort. My mom definitely had ADHD. I mean, these things are very, you know, genetic. So, and I, you know, respected and admired my mom so much. So I didn't feel, thankfully, this differentness is bad, but I knew there was something different. And I think for some people, unfortunately, that different feeling can lead to them feeling like I'm different in a bad way. I'm going to stand out in a bad way. And frankly, some of these kids, you know, when you talk about the education system, we do have a lot more work in different countries, because I've worked with people and know people from different parts of the world. And I understand, like, you have to sort of educate to the mainstream. And at the same time, it doesn't even take radical things sometimes to do to ground that ADHD student as well. So when you feel like a lot of people can feel like failures in school and not good enough. And then body image in general, whether we're talking about what we see in eating disorders or BDD, can sometimes be this compensation for this is something I can control. This is something I can, if I can achieve this, I can look quote unquote perfect I know what I need to do to, because I work with primarily men, but I work with women as well, whether it's I can be super muscular or I can be, you know, really thin. I can control what I put in my mouth in terms of food. I can count my calories. And so it's this almost kind of, there's a structure. And people with ADHD, we have this kind of love-hate relationship with structure. We kind of hate it on one hand, but we do really well with structure, you know, at the same time. And I think that piece of it, and then the feedback with ADHD individuals need feedback kind of instantly. And there's something when you're stepping on a scale and that number is either going up or it's going down. When you look in a mirror, you can see your face is getting thinner or it's getting puffier. Like that feedback and that visual kind of cue can be very, very reinforcing. So I think all of those things, and we do know that ADHD, and particularly with binge eating disorder and bulimia nervosa, is highly comorbid. The impulsivity. In fact, the only FDA approved medication for binge eating disorder is Vyvanse, which is an ADHD medication. So that you'll also see that relationship of ADHD individuals being at higher risk for impulsive eating and eating disorders. And then because of that, they might overcompensate by excessive dieting, exercise, focus on the body. And so it all kind of sort of connects together that way.
Okay, that's really interesting. And you very much answered this question, but I'll ask it more directly, which is how does ADHD affect OCD?
Yeah, so I think with ADHD, I say unmanaged and untreated ADHD has the power to undermine the treatment of anything else that's comorbid with the ADHD. Mm. So if I would say that there's one thing I hope that listeners, clinicians, people who are hearing this would take is, please, please treat the ADHD. Don't dismiss it. Don't think that because the person isn't in school anymore, it's not a big deal or it's not an mm-hmm. issue, because it will, even therapy and treatment assumes a certain level of executive function. I mean, if you think about it, like if you look mm-hmm. at cognitive behavioral treatment, like you're asking people to monitor their mood. You're asking people to maybe write things down and remember to bring the piece of paper back in, you know, to the office. You're even in doing exposures. I mean, the first time I realized this is actually at my internship at McLean. It was at the OCDI, and I was working with a patient who had ADHD and OCD, and he had contamination issues. So we're doing an exposure where his hands are in garbage, are in trash, like gloppy, disgusting, you know, garbage. And this is something that really should have his anxiety at like a level 8 on a scale of 1 to 10. Yeah. And he seemed very calm, like unusually calm for someone who I know that this is a high. I said, what are you? Because of course, as we know, with exposure, you want the person to connect to the experience. Mm-hmm. My hands are in nasty garbage. People probably spit in this trash. There's half-eaten pizza crust in here. And I said, what are you thinking right now? He said, oh, I'm thinking about my family is planning a trip to Disney World. And and I'm looking and I'm thinking of all the rides I'm going to be going on. And he wasn't doing it. What's important is he wasn't doing it as an avoidant measure, like as a, I need to not be thinking about these germs and everything. It was just, his mind was just going to what was the most stimulating thing. And going to Disney World was more stimulating from as a positive stimulation than the negative stimulation of his hands in this garbage. Okay. And I thought, oh, no. We need you to be thinking about your hands in the trash. And that was the first time I realized, wow, the ADHD, if we're not paying attention to it, we could be assuming that patients are doing exposures, and maybe behaviorally he's doing the exposure, but cognitively there's nothing. There's going to be no habituation. Because the next time he does it, he might not be thinking about Disneyland, or that trip is done and his anxiety is sky high again. And it could be confusing to people to be like, wait a minute, what's going on here? So when you don't keep an eye on the ADHD, manage it, treat it, it will and can undermine even patients being late for sessions. Like I had a patient many years ago who had OCD and ADHD. And he would be 40 minutes late for a 50-minute session for weeks upon end. And it wasn't that he was avoidant. It wasn't that he didn't care. It wasn't that he was, you know, being resistant. I mean, these were terms, though, that were placed on him by previous therapists who had fired him, which pains me. But he said, please don't fire me. He's like, I've been fired before from therapists who said, oh, I don't think you want to really work on this. And I said, no, because I knew he had ADHD. I said, no, what's making it difficult? And stuff that I can relate to is someone with ADHD. He goes to leave the house and he realized, oh, I have this letter to mail. Let me mail this letter. Boom, there's 3 minutes shaved off. Oh, and then, oh, my gas is on empty. I need to fill up my tank. 10 minutes shaved off. And then he realized, oh, I didn't eat anything, or I forgot my key, my wallet, and he had to go back home. I mean, it was all executive functioning stuff, all related to the ADHD, none of which had to do with the OCD. So I realized, okay, and I said to him, well, number one, let's make use of the 10 minutes we have left. But number two is, right now, the treatment, before we really even address the OCD, is we got to get you here on time. But most importantly, I didn't want him to feel shamed by it, because ADHD and shame, as well as OCD with shame, can be a very central thing. And particularly with ADHD, there's almost a different level to it, because when you see other people just kind of fluidly do something, get to an appointment on time, read a book very easily, and you just can't do it that fluidly, there's a lot of shame around that can bubble up. You know, it's like, I'm not like everybody else. And if I can't get to an appointment on time, how can I ever think I'm going to be successful in life? And he was weighed down. And when I said, look, we're going to take the shame away, this is what ADHD is. And he had never understood it in that context. So that's what our treatment became, is focusing solely on getting him out the door to get him in on time. But that's treatment, rather than looking at it as, oh, we're not even getting to the treatment. That is the treatment. Then when the first time he was only 15 minutes late, we celebrated that. We're like, woohoo, like, this is awesome. And then we started working on the OCD. So you have to keep an eye on the ADHD and even in sessions. I mean, therapy sessions, you know, here can be, you know, typically 45 to 50 minutes. I don't assume when I'm working with someone with ADHD that their attention is totally regulated for those 45, 50 minutes. In my office, I have lots of fidget toys. I have a big office. We can sit on the floor. We can take a stretch break. We could move around the furniture. Like, I want the person to know, you know, to A, be attentive of that regulation, and not to feel like I'm going to take it personally if they are like, I've tuned out. And I tell patients all the time, if you literally just spaced out, just say, oh, can you repeat that? I just spaced out. I don't want them to feel, but that happens a lot. I've had patients who say that they feel like they're going to offend. And again, now if you take OCD, where a lot of people with OCD have hypermorality and they don't want to be offensive to people, they might feel, oh, that'll offend the therapist if I tell them I literally didn't hear what you said in the last 10 minutes. And then they're not attentive. So tuning in with your patient and making sure, because that ADHD it's just always there. It's always present in that way. You just want to make sure it's not kind of, you know, getting in the way, you know, in that way. So always assessing it, keeping an eye on it, making sure when they're doing exposures that they're really thinking of the exposure and not somewhere else, you know, in that kind of way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And yeah, my next question was going to be around adapting treatment or enhancing ERP. So you've mentioned some stuff there. Obviously, if their minds wandered off to some other positive stimulant, is there anything else to be wary of or to adapt around ERP?
Yeah, I would say sometimes what I found is with patients, because of that, I find in a lot of ways, I have to almost start in a higher rung of the hierarchy when ADHD is present. It's almost like it has to be anxiously stimulating enough that they're really kind of focused on it. So when ADHD is not present, you know, maybe somebody has, let's say, I don't know, like an 8-step hierarchy, and you might start them on step 2 or 3. I find in general with ADHD, I might start at like step 4 or 5. Like, it's a little bit higher, so that because we want basically the anxious stimulation to override any ability to even have their minds wander. It's like, oh my gosh, my hands are in garbage. Like that is the thought. Like we want them to connect and engage in that thought. In addition to that, if whatever kind of exposure is implementing other environmental things that just keep them grounded in that experience. And so whether it's a fidget toy, whether it's the lighting in the room, like being aware, so much of ADHD, I say, you know, like we kind of have to be our own researcher to figure out what grounds us in any kind of environment. And that includes even when we're doing exposures. I will never, like, the thing you never would do is say to a patient, okay, so you have self-directed ERPs this week, you know, do them every day. And then when we meet next week, no, it has to be specific, specific, specific. So 7, and I often pick a time that's odd. Like I don't say 7 p.m. It might be 7:04 p.m. You know, every day, that's when you're going to do your exposure. And you'll text me right before and right after, or send me an email, because people with ADHD, we need accountability. Okay. And I always say, like, because words like accountability sound so harsh, at least to those of us with ADHD, we're like, you know, we have a term in the ADHD community of being an accountabuddy. So I'll be your accountabuddy, where if you know that somebody is kind of bearing witness to a process, you're more likely to kind of be plugged into it. That's why, like, if you go into a coffee shop, like here in the States, you know, we have Starbucks. And you'll see, I mean, now with COVID, it's been a little different, but certainly prior to COVID, people who would do better work with their laptops in a Starbucks, in a coffee shop, than they would in their quiet home. Those are people that are benefiting somehow from the accountability, even if it's strangers. It doesn't even have to be someone you know, but the idea that someone is bearing witness to what you're doing there. So if, let's say, you're supposed to be doing work and you suddenly go on Netflix, it's not that anyone in that coffee shop is going to be like, hey, you need to be doing work, but it's almost like you become more aware of it. So instituting that accountability and knowing that any clinician who's working with an ADHD patient, you are kind of taking on sort of coaching aspects are going to be part of the treatment. And to know that you're not enabling a patient, because this is something even with parents, we talk about all the time, that fine line between support and enabling. But the fact is that people with ADHD do have a lot of executive functioning issues. And so they need that kind of support, that accountability. So that's what we would do. I don't, you know, have patients write stuff down. They have their phone, they do audio diaries around like their exposures, because those years ago, before we had iPhones and things like that, I mean, you'd have people have pieces of paper where they write down. The ADHD patient would, I mean, I laugh at it because I've been there, done that myself. Like they lose it. They're like, oh, it got lost in the laundry. It's got washed with my pants. And, you know, oh, I forgot I even had to write something down, but people always have their phone. And so they can take video. And then I'm like, okay, let's open your phone. And there's a video or audio diary right there. So it's accommodating in the same way that we want to see in the educational system, that we want to see in workplace settings, where people just have to kind of be aware of all of the ways that that could be impacting the OCD.
Yeah, fascinating. I'm learning a lot here. This question actually came from a listener who emailed me, and they want to know, can you treat OCD without the need for stimulant medication for ADHD? And they've made a note of that it can worsen OCD for some. Is that the case?
That's a great question. So from a medication, a psychopharmacological point of view, so with OCD, typically we have the SSRIs. With ADHD, you either have a stimulant medication or non-stimulants like Strattera. The stimulants are certainly the first line, you know, treatment. So when OCD and ADHD are together, it really, because ADHD can manifest differently for different people. OCD can manifest differently for different people when they're together. You know, there are these things that are definitely that people with OCD and ADHD have in common. And then there's lots of things that are just different, you know, in that way. So as a result, the medication is that same way. I would say probably if I were to get, you know, any, like probably 60-40, where 60% of patients who have both can take both an SSRI and a stimulant. So sometimes the stimulant in regards to the OCD indirectly helps the OCD because somebody is properly able, more able to regulate their attention. So it means that if they have the intrusive thought of, oh, I'm going to harm my mom, they're better able to be like, oh no, that's just, you know, an intrusive thought, and better able to keep focused on the thing that they're supposed to focus on. Mm-hmm. Also, if the ADHD is managed, it means that they're probably less anxious. They're less stressed in general because they have their stuff together, you know, more. Mm-hmm. They're not in chaos kind of, you know, or running, you know, like a chicken with their head cut off. So indirectly, less stress could help, you know, prevent maybe some of the upticks of the OCD. So, and I see that as well with the body focused repetitive behaviors, sometimes dramatically, where people are like, oh my gosh, like I was like skin picking and then I started taking stimulants. And then they realize that sometimes maybe that behavior might be even more driven by the ADHD than they thought it was, that, you know, in terms of self-stimulation and self-soothing. Now, having said that, I would say the other 40%, at least in my practice, I don't know, I don't think there have been enough studies that have really looked at it from a larger scale. The stimulants do exacerbate the OCD. And by that is that the stimulants are enabling, the stimulants are working, but they're unintentionally working, which means that the person says, yeah, I'm better able to focus, but unfortunately I'm focusing on my obsessive thought more. Mm. And I don't want to be focused on that. So it can definitely make them more anxious. For some individuals with body focused repetitive behaviors, it can make those behaviors worse. It can exacerbate tics in some people who are prone to tic disorder or Tourette's. So the stimulants would not be helpful. Now, non-stimulant medication like Strattera is a very common non-stimulant medication that can be indicated, and that often does not have that same exacerbation effect. In fact, that Strattera or atomoxetine is the term, is often clinically used for people with ADHD and anxiety, that you'll find. Now, the difference though is that with atomoxetine, you have to take it daily. Stimulant, you don't have to take every day. Some people do take it every day. Some people take it during periods of time where they really need it, you know, more. So, and it takes a little bit longer for it to kick in, the atomoxetine, than your typical kind of stimulant. But I always tell people the benefit with stimulant medication is it's the most trial-friendly class of medications that we have, in that you know the day you take them, how they're going to respond, the day you take them, maybe 2 days tops. And if it, and I've had patients who are like, oh yeah, no, my obsessions are running through the roof. And then with their psychiatrist, they go off them. It takes about a day. It has a very short half-life, so it cleans out of the system very quickly. And then they might try another one. Now, that's the other thing to mention is that stimulants, there's a whole bunch of stimulants. And so someone might do poorly on Ritalin, might not do the trick, but Adderall, which is also a stimulant, might help them tremendously. So even amongst the stimulants, I always tell people try, like, and I say, you know, people might feel like a lab rat, but that's kind of what it is, because ultimately you're your own individual. Some people might have to try three or four different ADHD meds, maybe different dosages, maybe the short acting versus the long acting, to kind of work with your prescriber, if that's something, because with a number of my patients, they'll say, I'd rather have the medication for the ADHD and work behaviorally on the OCD if they just want to be on one medication, because the ADHD is almost, it could be more impairing for them. And then for other patients, it's like, oh no, I can deal with the ADHD. This OCD is so tormenting and literally destroying me. I need the medication for that. And then there are people that can take both. So it really can vary.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a great answer. Yeah. Loads of detail in that. Cool. So I guess the question is, I assume that ADHD is, and you've mentioned it actually, is missed quite a lot or underdiagnosed, probably in the general population, but specifically with people with OCD. I guess, why is that? And why more so with women too?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So ADHD gets accused of being overly diagnosed. And the reality is, from research, now I have absolutely worked with people, done consultations with people who are diagnosed with ADHD who in fact do not have ADHD. They might have OCD, they might have bipolar disorder, they might have a sleep disorder, they could have an addiction that, you know, we need to get them sober first to see. Having said that, I have far, far more worked with patients who have not been diagnosed with ADHD, who have ADHD. And then in our work together, it becomes very clear to me, there is ADHD, you know, present. I think a lot of that just in general is still, there are so many myths about ADHD, particularly with older people. I have to say the good news is that the identification and diagnosis is better now than it's ever been, and amongst young people, and there's less of a stigma with young people now. Like a lot of the kids I work with don't have, they have more of the stigma when they don't get diagnosed, because then they just feel stupid, you know, and they just feel, so when they have AD, they're like, oh, okay. Like, because chances are they have a friend or five that have ADHD. They've seen TikTok videos about ADHD, like it's out there, you know, that way. Whereas a lot of older adults, there can still be a lot of stigma, you know, partially because they might have been given a lot of negative messaging when they were younger around, you're not trying hard enough, you're not, you know, you're lazy, you know, those kinds of things. So, but in the presence of OCD, and I understand this, it can be very difficult to tease out. And a lot of times the attention issues could all be subsumed under, oh, well, that's part of OCD. Of course, you're not paying attention in class because you're riddled by your intrusive thoughts. Well, my patients who have OCD and ADHD could tell you, and I would say this is probably 90% of the time, even as young, the young kids I work with, they know when it's the OCD happening or the ADHD happening. They can tell you. Like they'll say, yeah, I was in class and I was so bored and my head just started daydreaming. And then I started obsessing because I was bored. So it was like ADHD first, then it gave rise to the OCD. And then other times they'll say, yep, I was engaged. And then suddenly the teacher said a trigger, said the word cancer. And then the OCD hijacked my brain. And I thought, oh my gosh, my mom's going to get cancer. Then they, that leads to an attention dysregulation. So OCD first, which leads to sort of more that kind of that in attention issues. So a lot of times those issues get subsumed there. Things like hoarding or those kinds of things like that. It's like, oh, well, this is hoarding, without understanding that ADHD could be a major part of that. If not, could be the reason for the hoarding, you know, that the hoarding could be a symptom of the ADHD. So it does take, for people who suspect that they might have both, you know, seeing a clinician who has experience with both of those, or just seeing someone who has ADHD experience, getting just an evaluation around that, in addition to working with your OCD therapist to really tease that out. You mentioning women, which I'm glad you brought up, because ADHD is underdiagnosed. It's particularly underdiagnosed amongst girls and women, amongst people of color. And you'll still see it today where it says boys outnumber girls 3-1. Boys outnumber girls 3-1 in identification. They do not outnumber girls in terms of the actual prevalence. Girls with ADHD are less likely to be hyperactive, are less likely to be sort of the traditional kind of rambunctious kids, but that's not because they don't feel that necessarily. It's because, you know, we still, there's still a lot of social norms of how boys should be and how girls should be, even though a lot of that is changing for the better, but there's still a ways to go. So, and a lot of girls internalize those symptoms by overcompensating. And so you might see high degrees of perfectionism, a lot of anxiety, that actually anxiety can almost mitigate some of those ADHD symptoms, although that's not sustainable over time. You will burn out from it. But if you're a perfectionist, if you have ADHD, perfectionism can get you through sort of some of those things. So girls and women, absolutely very, very underdiagnosed in that.
Yeah, thank you for that. It's interesting because it's exactly the same in autism, right? Girls are seriously underdiagnosed there too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm. Yep. Yeah. And to also keep in mind too, with ADHD, because it's comorbid with so many other things, but one of the things to also keep in mind is 50 to 60% of people with ADHD have a learning disability, dyslexia being the most common of those learning disabilities. So now when you have ADHD present, I always say, especially for certainly for someone who's in school, is always, always, always screen for the presence of a learning disability. When you have a 50 to 60% comorbidity, it would be almost irresponsible not to screen for learning disability. So if there's OCD with ADHD and possibly dyslexia or learning disability of how you process information and how you encode things, I mean, that's really important to understand as well in terms of, again, their ability to engage even in the treatment. I've had patients who are dyslexic who, like, even being aware of, I worked with someone who had OCD around rereading, and they had to reread things a certain number of times. Now, they also had dyslexia. They also had ADHD. So part of it was, well, it started with I did have to reread things because I wouldn't focus and pay attention. And they didn't know at the time that they were dyslexic. So it did take a lot of time. And then they also have OCD, and OCD came out in other ways as well. But one of the ways it came out is that it wasn't enough to just reread it from the sort of neurodiversity perspective. But then it became, I have to reread it 25 times. And they knew after the third or fourth time, like, I know that I got it, but then the OCD would have me doubt. Are you sure you got it? Maybe you read it wrong. Maybe you're not getting. And then it just, so they really, sometimes these conditions can morph with each other. And it can, sometimes part of the work is teasing out, you know, who's the bus driver, I often say, like, who's driving the bus here in terms of the OCD, the ADHD, potential learning disabilities and things like that, that are all part of this picture.
Yeah. 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 That's really fascinating. Okay. So we're going to slightly change direction now. So if you could pick up the phone and call the 20-year-old version of Roberto, what would you tell him?
Oh my gosh. The 20-year-old version is, that's a really, really good question. I would say trust your instincts. Know that there is so much more to kind of learn and to know, and that knowledge is ever evolving. And, you know, you will sort of learn more about yourself as that knowledge becomes available and open to you. But also, yeah, just continue to just believe in yourself and trust your instincts. And then probably appreciate and be aware of, you know, your sleep and your things that you were very, I was very impulsive with money back then. My sleep habits were horrific. Very, very impulsive person, very impulsive kid. And so I would say just be careful to know that, you know, you want to be healthy, because I do. I want to live a very, very long life. Take care of yourself now, because even though you're only 20 and you feel like you're invincible, you're not. And, you know, when you're 30, 40, 50, you want to appreciate that. So be more mindful to those things and appreciate those things. And I feel in the work that I do, especially with ADHD, I often feel like I'm talking to younger versions of myself with these young people that I work with. And I tell them, I'm like, look, I get it. Because you'll hear people be, oh, you should sleep 6 or 7, 8 hours. And it's so important, and blah, 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 blah. Like, you know, we hear that. But as someone, I can tell you, like, please work on those things now, because it really, it can, like, I've had very wacky things happen to my body because I just totally looked at sleep as disposable. You know, like, my motto was sleep happens when all the fun is done and when there's nothing left to do, which, hey, it made for very fun times when I was young. And at the same time, like, you don't get sleep for multiple nights in a row. And, you know, that's, you get mono and you get shingles and you get things that you're like, why is this happening to me? So I would say just be more aware of your health. But then also, there are parts that I look at my 20-year-old self and I'm like, yeah, I did you know, some things in really good ways too. And just accept, like, my, you know, the serenity prayer, the serenity statement is like a big mantra of mine, is just, you know, put energy into the things that you can control, let go of the things that you just have no control over, and, you know, the wisdom to know the difference. And that's my life. That's my life philosophy. I wake up every day and I say that to myself.
Amazing. Yeah, awesome. And then lastly, you've got a billboard. What do you want written on that billboard?
Billboard, yeah. Is B, would probably just B-E with a big period, just B. Like, my thing is just, a lot of my work, you know, although I treat OCD and I treat ADHD, I treat eating disorders, but I really feel a lot of what I do, to me, very much has like the spiritual core to it, of just, I hope and want for people to just be their authentic selves and just live lives authentically. And, you know, free of as much as we can of, we can't be free of pain, because pain is part of human life, but, you know, of the unnecessary, you know, kind of, you know, pain, and just to accept ourselves, you know, as we are, whether it's for mental health struggles that we might have, or, you know, people who are, you know, with sexuality or ethnicity, whatever it is, you know, just be, and know that that's where you're going to have your most power, is in just being, you know, authentic. And that's probably, and then the other word that came to mind, my favorite word is actually go, G-O. I just love that word, go. Like, there's something so kinetic about that word. And my favorite band are the Go-Go's, or one of my favorite bands. So, but I love that word because it's a verb and it's just kinetic. It's like, just go, just don't. And this is where I credit my ADHD, is like, don't hesitate, don't hold back, don't restrain, don't be rigid, be flexible, just go, like, just go for it. Because people in life tend to regret more the things that they don't do than regret the things that they do. So yeah, I guess the billboard would be B, big period, and go with an exclamation point. Nice. And then a smiley face and maybe a musical note, just to my homage to bring music in your life.
Yeah, nice. I like that. And lastly, on the topic, is there anything else you wish you could have said or shared today?
No, I think this is great. I mean, first of all, I appreciate you doing this podcast, because honestly, the word out, and, you know, the power of this medium, is it reaches people all over the world. I mean, you know, when you do podcasts, like, I get floored, you know, when I get emails from people from Turkey and from Greece and from Australia and the UK and different parts of the US that, who just wouldn't have had access sometimes to that information. So thank you for doing this topic, because it isn't talked about sort of enough, in that. So yeah, other than that, I think we covered everything really well.
Cool. Yeah, no, it's my pleasure to cover it, and thank you for your time and expertise. I mean, I personally learned a lot. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip / donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. And thank you to NoCD for supporting our work. If you want to find out more about NoCD, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.